presidents typically use a stringent standard for vetting federal judges and Supreme Court justices. But until now, that hasn't been so much the case in Arizona.
Are you asking questions that are attempting to lock that judge into a specific position where perhaps they've prejudged a case that comes before them?
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, the link between the end of the Cold War and the rise of global terrorism, how effective criminal justice reform can maintain public safety and save the state money.
Parents react to results from the new AZ merit test.
And the state's wine industry is growing.
It didn't get off to a very fast start. It took a long time for us to kind of get over the hump of all of the technical problems that were involved in growing wine in this climate.
Plus, a valley band combines garage and surf music and a ballpark birthday.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic on the 101 northbound in the West Valley, the crash at Camelback is now just on the shoulder, although it still looks like there's a pretty sizable backup behind it. Elsewhere, accidents I-70 northbound in Union Hills and I-70 northbound at Greenway. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon today with a high of 78 degrees. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the low to mid 50s. Sunny and a little warmer tomorrow with a high of 79, 76 for a high under sunny skies on Sunday. It's sunny right now, 74 degrees at KJZZ.
The Arizona Department of Corrections is making some changes to how it monitors its privately run prisons. This follows a series of reports about the state's privately run facilities. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports.
The reviews were triggered after the state ended a contract with one of its six private prison operators, Management and Training Corporation. The company was found to be in continuous violation of several department policies and lost its contract for the Kingman Prison. Assessments of the state's other five facilities found the majority of the wardens were not having regular meetings with staff, training wasn't up to department standards, and the emergency response plans weren't comprehensive. The department announced it would change how monitors evaluate the private facilities. The monitors will now spend more of their time touring the prisons. The department also issued corrective action plans to each of the five facilities about specific problems they need to fix to come into compliance with their state contracts. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
21 people were killed today in the West African country of Mali when gunmen stormed a hotel in the capital taking hostages. Officials say they don't believe any hostages are still inside the building. My next guest believes the rise of global terrorism has its roots in the end of the Cold War. Alex Braithwaite is an associate professor of international relations at the University of Arizona. Alex, how are the two connected?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question, I think. That what we've observed is indeed an increase in transnational forms of violence, both terrorism and what we would call internationalized civil wars or domestic conflicts. And I think this relates back to the Cold War insofar as at the conclusion of the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union becoming Russia changed their preferences in terms of the global order. They're no longer quite so obsessed with monitoring one another's behavior, which means that they change the way in which they manage regional conflicts. So I think a lot of this violence existed, but it was localized, it was domestic, and it was kept under wraps by the major powers during the Cold War. So at the conclusion of the Cold War, we see those major powers releasing somewhat their pressure on those local conflicts, which gives them an opportunity to expand in geographic scope. So I think the motivations behind violence remain quite similar as those during the Cold War. It's just that we now can observe these conflicts, and many of the actors engaged in them, such as Al-Qaeda and ISIS, are able to engage in their forms of violence in a transnational setting.
Were those types of terrorist groups operating in the same way back then? Did they have the same philosophical beliefs? Do they have the same techniques that they do now?
So many of the techniques that are used currently existed back in the Cold War. We might think of, for instance, hijacking of airliners, mass shootings, as we've seen recently, as tactics that were actually used quite commonly in the late 60s and early 70s, especially by Palestinian organizations. Suicide bombing really is introduced to us globally in the early 1980s in the conflict in Lebanon. And so it's safe to say that all of the forms of violence that we've observed over the last week and over recent years existed during the Cold War as well.
Do you think that the changes made after the Cold War ended, as far as maybe not trying to tamp down quite so much on some of these groups, and maybe these groups operating more in the open, we hear about them over greater distances, was that a decision that the countries made, or was that just an issue of they didn't have the power anymore to control them the way that they did before?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's perhaps a little bit of both. I think there are certain conflicts which we anticipated would escalate at the end of the Cold War, but there are many that occurred without great expectation. So conflicts in Yugoslavia, for instance, I think came as a meaningful surprise to many policymakers and academics alike. So I think probably it's safe to say that these conflicts have emerged in a way that wasn't fully anticipated, though it is the case that many scholars at the time were recognizing that the kinds of conflicts we would observe would be different. So there were scholars that were saying, we'll observe more civil war, we'll observe more non-state actor violence.
Is there a way that we can use what we learned in the Cold War and sort of in the aftermath of it to apply to trying to fight some of these terrorist groups now?
Yeah, this is really tricky. It's very attractive to talk about the use of military force at the moment, because I think after deadly attacks, populations are very wary of offering anything by way of concessions to those that have inflicted great harm. But I think if we learned anything from the Cold War into the post-Cold War period, it was that there are transitions in which local populations can achieve autonomy that are largely peaceful.
Alex Braithwaite is an associate professor of international relations at the University of Arizona. Alex, thank you.
Thank you.
Efforts across the country have accelerated recently on criminal justice reform and reducing sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. Today, the Morrison Institute for Public Policy at ASU has been hosting the State of Our State Conference. The topic is whether criminal justice is the answer to Arizona's fiscal woes. The keynote speaker is San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon, who also served as Mesa's police chief. George, how do you find the balance between public safety and wanting to save money in a government budget?
I would tell you that I would never argue for savings if I thought that it was compromising safety. But what we know now, and that we have a lot of data because we have been in this process for the last 30-some years where we increasingly became more punitive and increasingly incarcerated more people. What we know now is that you can actually reduce your population and your prison system if you do it thoughtfully, and you can still continue to enjoy significant reductions in crime and good public safety. I can tell you, for instance, in California, from 2006 to 2012, we reduced our prison population by over 40,000 people. We did it primarily because there were court orders, and there was a tremendous problem with overcrowding. During that period of time, we continued to enjoy significant reductions in crime. So there's no correlation between releasing people that are in prison primarily for drug-related offenses and public safety. On the other hand, where there's a significant correlation is people that we lock up for low-level offenses and we mix in with more serious offenders. When they come out, they're generally doing worse than when they went in the first place.
You were police chief in Mesa, and you've been district attorney in San Francisco for the past number of years. And certainly when someone looks at it from the outside, they think, well, San Francisco philosophies are a little bit different than Phoenix area philosophies in terms of the political philosophies and whatnot. In a place like Arizona, would there be more struggles with people saying, sort of trying to do the what we call traditionally the law and order thing, where they're saying, you know, I'm tough on crime, and if you change this, you're not tough on crime?
Yeah, actually, I don't think so. And let me tell you why. I have two very good examples. One of them is Texas. In 2007, Texas was facing a significant need to increase their prison capacity by about 12,000 people. And after a lot of conversations, they decided to actually go out and get the data and do a real analysis of what the needs were in Texas. And they sort of reversed that trend. They reduced prison capacity, and they took the money and reinvested into drug services for people with drug addictions and mental health. Texas has been able to reduce their prison population significantly, and at the same time, they have been able to reduce their crime during the same period of time. You take California. Last year, we did a voters initiative. It was a statewide initiative. It was called Prop 47, which reduced all drug possession cases for personal use from felonies to misdemeanors. And the support came across the board from both the right and the left. In fact, most of the funding for Prop 47 was equally divided between conservatives, Republicans, and very liberal Democrats. It passed by 60% of the vote, and we're already seeing incredible results in terms of the savings and in terms of how we're dealing with this population. So this is clearly not a left or a right issue. It is really, quite frankly, is a defining moment for our nation.
Will it take someone at the state legislature, someone in the governor's office to say, I support this, or can it be more grassroots?
I think there's a combination, right? I think that there's definitely a grassroots movement that is taking place in many places, including Arizona. But I think also we're seeing conservative legislators in Arizona and in other parts of the country that are saying, hey, we need to start doing business differently. Then you need to tailor your policies to your community. You know, every community is going to be slightly different, and you have to make sure that you're reflecting the local community norms and the local community needs. But even with all that put into place, certainly Arizona can benefit greatly from reducing the prison population.
George Gascon is District Attorney of San Francisco. He's also the former police chief of Mesa. He's in the Valley today for the Morrison Institute's State of Our State Conference. He's the keynote speaker. George, thank you for the time.
Steve, my pleasure. You take care.
Coming up, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey is changing how the state vets judicial finalists. We'll hear more on the show.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. Quickly checking Valley traffic. I-17 northbound, a crash blocks the shoulder at Union Hills. Just a bit south of there, also on I-17 northbound, a crash blocks the shoulder at Greenway. The earlier collision on the 101 northbound in the West Valley has cleared. Look for sunny skies across the valley for the rest of the day today with a high of 78 degrees. We hit 76 yesterday, 73 is average. It'll be clear tonight with overnight lows in the low to mid 50s. Sunny tomorrow with a high of 79, 76 for a high on Sunday, also under sunny skies. Right now in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 21%, it's sunny, 76 degrees at KJZZ at 216.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, celebrating the 8th annual Subaru Share the Love event, which has contributed more than $65 million to charity. Shop Subaru.com.
When U.S. presidents get the opportunity to pick a new member of the Supreme Court, the vetting process is intense. Staffers do background checks and go through file after file for opinions judges have written or potentially controversial things they've said about issues of the day. That's not the kind of thing usually done at the state level, but the Ducey administration is spending more time talking with judicial finalists, including those who are possible successors to retired state Supreme Court Justice Rebecca White Birch. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a former member of the Napolitano administration. But first, I'm joined by Mike Liberti, general counsel for the Ducey administration. Mike, what's going on with the new process?
I've been involved in about 16 or so judicial selections by Governor Ducey so far this year. And about halfway through it, the deputy general counsel and I sat down and had a little discussion about what's going well, what could be improved upon, and we decided that we needed to have an opportunity to meet with each of these judicial applicants prior to their meeting with the governor. And that would be a way for us to get to know them a little better and for the applicants to get to know us a little bit better prior to their interview with Governor Ducey.
Would you consider this vetting? Would you consider this more to be sort of a, let me sort of get your judicial philosophy?
I think it's probably all of the above. So what happens at the federal level is the president gets to nominate whoever he wants, and it's subject only to Senate confirmation. So at the nomination phase, the president is going to want to nominate somebody who gets through the Senate. What we are doing after the commission send us the list of names for the governor's consideration is we're taking a really hard look at each of these candidates. What kind of a person are they? What is their legal background? What's their judicial philosophy? What's their legal philosophy? How deep is their substantive legal knowledge on areas of criminal law, on civil law, family law, those sorts of things? So prior to getting to Governor Ducey, me and the Deputy General Counsel and a few others take that really hard look at each candidate in order to get as much information as we can prior to the governor's appointment.
How much does this play into the background of Governor Ducey? We often hear about his business background, how he conducted business. Is this a more business-minded approach?
I think it is. Not only a business approach from the governor's background, but also from my legal background, where in a law firm, you would typically have multiple levels of interviews just to hire a law student to spend a summer at the law firm. And then at a business organization where you may have a screening interview, a callback interview with multiple members of the organization, and then maybe a final interview before the decision is made. It's also important to keep in mind that for judges where the merit system has played a role in their appointment, they're going to be in office until they hit the age of 70, which is the mandatory retirement age under the Constitution, or the voters don't retain them from office in the retention elections. So the governor takes his role in appointing these judges very seriously, wants to make sure that he makes the best possible choice.
Is there any concern that this will be seen as adding politics to the mix when you have the governor even more involved?
No, absolutely not. And with respect to political decisions, I think it's important to keep in mind that the political branches often go to the courts to ask the courts to resolve their disputes. So there's inevitably going to be politics at the center stage when courts are deciding issues. And let me maybe answer your question in another way. Governor Ducey has made 16 appointments to various courts. Of those 16 appointments, 4 have been Democrats and 2 are independents. Governor Ducey looks at each person who applies for a judicial spot with an eye toward their integrity and their legal knowledge and their fit to be a judge.
Mike Liberti is general counsel for Governor Doug Ducey's administration. Mike, thank you for the insight.
Thank you so much, Steve.
For another perspective, I'm joined by Valley attorney Tim Nelson. He was general counsel in the Napolitano administration. Tim, do any specific concerns come to mind for you in this new vetting process?
Well, sure. Obviously, knowing more about the applicant is a good thing in general. But one of the things you have to be careful of is the process becoming such that it's intruding on the judicial independence of the eventual judge? Are you asking questions that are attempting to lock that judge into a specific position where perhaps they've prejudged a case that comes before them? The litigants in Arizona and around the country have a right to expect that their cases will be heard by impartial judges based on the facts of the specific case, not based on some sort of predetermined promise of how they're going to rule in certain types of cases.
Governor Ducey's counsel, Mike Liberti, told me this is not going to politicize the process, but could it?
I think anything like this has the potential to do that. Mike is a very good lawyer, and I trust that he has a good feel for what's appropriate and what's not appropriate in that regard. And the overall policy of trying to get more information about the judicial candidates is something that's not controversial at all. It's just what the details are in terms of what the questions turn out to be.
It seems like every couple of years at least, some members of the state legislature want to make some changes to how the judicial system works. There does seem to be that fight between those two branches of government. Does this indicate anything to you that
the executive branch is jumping into this fight, or are these completely separate issues?
Well, I think we have to see how it actually turns out. It'll be interesting to hear from applicants what some of the questions are, and there always is a discussion of how the interviews go, particularly among the candidates who aren't successful and want to reapply. So it'll be very interesting to see what types of questions do get asked. But, you know, I think that we have seen, and I'm not saying that necessarily Governor Ducey is part of this movement, but we certainly have seen in Arizona and around the country more and more efforts to try to intrude on the independence of the judiciary. And I think that's very concerning. And I think the system that we had in Arizona for judicial selection was a strong one at keeping a truly independent but very highly qualified judiciary.
Are there any concerns that when you have a governor who's more involved, a governor who is a politician, clearly, I mean, that's what, when you run for office, you're a politician, who may be looking for litmus tests, even if it's not obvious, are there certain issues that might concern you that might come up in these sorts of things?
The one thing I think that we have a right to know is whether a judicial candidate will follow what the legal doctrine of stare decisis, which means, are you going to accept the fact that the decisions that have been previously announced by our courts are binding legal precedent on that will guide the cases that are before you? I think it's a proper question to ask of any nominee. Are there any cases for which you wouldn't follow stare decisis? Are there any rules articulated by our courts that you would not follow? But to get into specific subject matters and ask an applicant in advance how they're going to rule on a case related to that subject matter, I think is inappropriate.
Attorney Tim Nelson, he's a former member of the Napolitano administration. Tim, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
More and more robots are coming, and they may be taking our jobs. But maybe that's not such a bad thing. Some researchers are even suggesting a solution to a robotic workforce is a guaranteed minimum income for humans, whether they work or not. Several cities in the Netherlands are piloting the idea of a universal basic income. The BBC's Richard Walker has been following the idea and begins with Federico Pistono, author of Robots Will Steal Your Job, But That's Okay.
Things that are used to be primarily done by humans and then we thought were the only thing that differentiated us between us and animals, or us and machines in this case. But now machines are taking over and they are doing jobs such as lawyers. They're taking over telemarketing. They're taking over any kind of data processing, making sense of a lot of information, putting it together, clustering data. A lot of this stuff is going to be done by robots. And that's hundreds of millions of jobs worldwide.
Hopefully we manage to stay in control of the robots and not the other way around. That being the case, what if the robots doing our jobs meant we could spend more time doing things that make us happy and meant we could still receive an income? Sounds like a pipe dream? Think again. More than a dozen Dutch cities are preparing to trial the idea of an unconditional basic income. Sjur Huymakers is a mathematical consultant advising many of them. So, does the basic income idea mean people being handed free cash with no questions asked?
That's the basic idea. You actually free people from all kinds of checks or controls, from the duties they have right now. They have to apply for a job every week, and you free them from that and give them more personal freedom.
If you give people free cash, won't they lose the incentive to work?
Some people might think this, but if you look at research that's been done so far, it doesn't really show this. What's most probable is that people just keep working, mostly. They'll work, maybe they'll do different work, maybe more work that they find more fulfilling. They might take a bit more time off to care for their family, for example. That's what you might expect, but we don't know, so that's what we want to see.
The experts say the reality of cognitive job displacement, computers taking your job, is a reality coming soon that must be addressed. But where would the cash come from to pay for it? If applied to the population of a city or even a whole country, wouldn't it bankrupt us? Author Federico Pistono says building a national fund is the way to go.
You could do it with any kind of activity or resource that is common heritage or common property of the entire population of the country. For example, Italy is full of artistic value. It could be with physical resources. It could be with the land itself that you lease out. It could be with profits from the top 1,000 corporations of the country, or it could be with a percentage of wealth, like a wealth tax. There are a million ways to finance a basic income. The choice is really just political. And even if the basic income is, let's say, 140 or 200 euros per month, that is a start.
I'm a team manager in a contact center.
Do you worry that at some point in the future, a robot could take your job?
Well, I think my job is a people job, so I don't think some robot can take that.
What would you think of a free, unconditional basic income from the government?
Well, I like my job, so I don't think I would take that.
I work for Philips TV business.
Do you worry that a robot might one day steal your job?
Not particularly, no. Not yet, not within my lifetime.
How would you feel about the government giving you 1,000 euros a month or some kind of income per month without asking any questions?
There's no such thing as a free lunch, right? So wouldn't be too enticed to take it, no.
Do you worry that a robot might steal your job?
No, but I do hope so. I do hope they do one day.
What would you say to a free income from the government, no questions asked, of, say, 1,000 euros a month? What would you think of that?
I'd be curious what was really attached to it, what was expected.
It seems there's a certain amount of denial that the robots are coming, but it's perhaps comforting that by the time they are here en masse, we might have a free basic income waiting for us to help cushion the blow.
The BBC's Richard Walker reporting. Parents have been getting their kids' AZ merit test scores this week. That's the new standardized test that replaced AIMS. And districts have been warning parents those scores would likely be lower than what they're used to seeing. To get a sense of how parents are reacting to the scores, I'm joined by Anne-Eve Peterson, a parent and education advocate. Anne-Eve, what are you hearing?
Well, I think that people are sort of in a wait-and-see mode here. I don't sense that there is a lot of panic or distress about what's occurring at this stage. And really, the punitive pieces to this type of testing have been suspended. So keeping third graders back if they're not at reading proficiency levels, not allowing kids to graduate if they don't do well enough on this test, even the assigning of letter grades to schools has been temporarily suspended. Now, as the punitive measures to this start to go into effect, which they will, then I think you can see the potential for a big outcry.
Are there things that you think that we should be looking for or watching for as scores continue to come in, even maybe in future years?
I think one of the big concerns, or one of the big red flags I would see coming about, is what we know from the test results that have already been cumulatively released. 44% of third graders are deemed to be minimally proficient in reading. Now, when the punitive measures go into effect, many of these children could be held back and not allowed to go on to fourth grade. And that would, I assume, cause and create great distress among parents.
Why do you think it is that parents have been so seemingly calm about this? I mean, for a lot of parents, their students' results are a lot less good than they were when they took the AIMS test.
I think people who have, been watching this know that that is to be expected because this test is designed intentionally to be much harder than the AIMS test. And again, I think because the punitive measures have not gone into effect, you aren't going to see a huge outcry, I don't think, until those start being put back into effect. And, you know, there also has not been, I'll just say, I think the rollout of all of this has been just very flawed. So there's been a lack of good communication from the state level for quite some time now. And I'm not sure that most parents even are aware of what is going on, what will be at stake in the future. Although there was, you know, sort of a political outcry about the Common Core, I don't know that that really reached down into the deeper levels of parental understanding about this. I think this is just, I hate to call it a little ticking time bomb, but I think in essence that's what we're sitting on.
Anne-Eve Peterson is an education advocate and parent. We are talking about how parents are reacting to their kids' AZ merit test scores. Still to come, success comes to Arizona winemakers that are true to their roots.
Arizona's wine industry has really grown the last few years, I think, because we're starting to figure out what we need to be putting in the ground instead of what the owner or the winemaker wants to put in the ground.
We'll lift a glass in just a few minutes. It's the show.
Good afternoon in Valley weather. We expect to have sunny skies for the rest of today, possibly reaching a high temperature of 78. And then for this weekend, sunny skies both Saturday and Sunday. We should top out at 79 tomorrow and then 76 on Sunday. Currently with relative humidity at 21%, we're at 76 degrees. Meanwhile, in Valley traffic, I-17 northbound, a couple of accidents, one at Greenway, the other at Union Hills. Both are blocking the shoulder. Shoulders also blocked by a collision on I-10 westbound at 59th Avenue. It's 2:34 at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Art Fest of Scottsdale this weekend, featuring 200 artists, music, food, and kids crafts at the Scottsdale Civic Center. Artist and entertainment list at 888artfest.com.
The Tax Foundation is out with its annual State Business Tax Climate Index. In the 2016 version, Arizona maintains its spot at number 24. Jared Walczak is a policy analyst at the Tax Foundation. Jared, what led to Arizona staying where it was?
Well, Arizona actually did see improvements on a component ranking this year. On the business component, there was a three-place improvement, and that is due to the first stage of the phase-in of the corporate income tax cuts. So we've seen the rate go from 6.5 to 6%. That helped the state improve three places on the business tax component. We'll probably see further improvement as those reductions continue to phase in all the way down to 4.9% in 2018. Beyond that, yeah, Arizona is competitive in the structure for its corporate income tax. The biggest challenge for Arizona has been the sales tax, and that's really what is holding the state back and keeping the middle of the pack.
When you talk about competition and where taxes fall in that, how closely do businesses look at a state's tax climate when they're deciding to locate somewhere or expand somewhere?
It's a significant consideration, certainly not the only one. Cost of living, an educated workforce, even the climate can be important considerations. But businesses absolutely care about the tax burdens they're facing. They can be extremely substantial.
So in looking at the most competitive states on your list for 2016, the top three are Wyoming, South Dakota, and Alaska. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Arizona is competing with those places for businesses?
Those states are unique in a number of ways. They're all resource extraction states. They all have an opportunity to export more of their tax burdens than most states do. But there are a number of states that have found ways to be extremely competitive despite not having those sort of unique factors. And Arizona is actually absolutely competing with many of those states. Of course, you have Nevada nearby, which has no corporate income tax, no individual income tax. They are paying a low-rate gross receipts tax, and they're paying the modified business tax, which is a payroll tax, so they have tax burdens. But a lot of businesses are looking at states like Nevada. We've seen a lot of companies fleeing states like California going to Nevada. Yeah, Arizona is competing regionally with states like Colorado, which has a better tax climate, Utah, yeah, Nevada. And, of course, states compete on a global scale as well.
Are there particular types of businesses that care more about a tax climate than others?
There are, and there are businesses that care more about different aspects of the tax structure. So a capital-intensive firm, think a manufacturer, a distribution center, they're going to care a lot about property taxes, both real and personal, because they might be paying property taxes not just on their land and their buildings, but also on their equipment and their inventory. Other companies might be much more interested in your traditional business taxes, like the corporate income tax. You know, all businesses are going to care about their tax burden, but some face much higher burdens than others. Ideally, a state should have as neutrally structured a tax code as possible so that you're not picking winners and losers.
Does it also matter sort of what else a state has to offer? You mentioned California, a lot of tech companies. There's obviously still a lot of, you know, folks going to California to open tech companies or start tech companies. People are still going to New York, you know, especially in the financial business and some other businesses. That was ranked 49th on your list among the least competitive states in the country. So I guess I'm curious, like, how much of everything else the state has, excluding the tax climate, plays into a business's decision?
Certainly. There are a lot of factors that go into a business's decision-making. An educated workforce, proximity to clients, or sort of a hub, an innovation hub or zone. So New York, you mentioned, you know, the financial sector still is largely located in New York, really in New York City, because it's where you want to be. It's where your competitors are, your peers are. It is a global capital. And despite the very high taxes, in many ways, it's still a very attractive place to be. But you also mentioned, say, Wyoming. Imagine if you put New York City's taxes or New York State's taxes and superimposed them in Wyoming. No one would live there anymore. It wouldn't be possible to function as Wyoming with those tax rates. So there are things that can be more important for some businesses than tax burden, and certainly no one would argue that taxes are the only consideration that a business, you know, takes into mind, but it's a very important one.
Jared Walczak is a policy analyst at the Tax Foundation. Jared, thank you.
Thank you.
While most everything around it has changed, there is one constant in the heart of the West's most western town. Scottsdale Stadium commemorates its 60th anniversary tomorrow afternoon when it hosts the championship game of the Arizona Fall League. KJZZ's Phil Latzman is here with more on the stadium's role in making Scottsdale what it is today.
The stadium actually opened 60 years ago today. It first served as spring training home of the Baltimore Orioles when the fledgling Cactus League had only four teams. It would eventually house spring training activities for the Boston Red Sox, Chicago Cubs, and Oakland A's. The San Francisco Giants have been the primary tenant there for more than 30 years. The stadium was rebuilt on the same site in 1992 and did undergo a $23 million renovation in 2006. I spoke with Scottsdale historian Joan Fudala about the significance of the stadium that still bears the city's name.
Well, Scottsdale and the stadium kind of grew up together. We were incorporated as a town in 1951. The stadium opened in 55, and up until the time that the stadium opened, we were still pretty much a farming community with a potential to be a tourism attraction, and it really helped to have spring training and the whole excitement around Major League Baseball here.
Is it fair to say that Scottsdale Stadium put Scottsdale on the map back in 1955?
It certainly helped. Again, we were becoming what we had hoped to be, a tourism attraction, and by having the games broadcast here and bringing in people from all over the country, yes, I really think it did help put us on the map.
Can you take us back in time 60 years and paint us a picture of what it was like at Scottsdale Stadium when they opened in 1955?
We were really small. We had a population of less than 5,000, basically centered around the downtown Scottsdale area as we know it today. The area around where the stadium was built at Osborne and what we now know as Drinkwater Boulevard was surrounded by cotton fields and alfalfa fields. So this was built on pretty much undeveloped area on the fringe of the downtown area. There were a few restaurants and bars and a few shops, some art galleries that had just opened up, and also we just had a few guest ranches. We didn't have any resorts. We didn't even have any year-round hotels at that time.
How did it come to be that Scottsdale Stadium was built 60 years ago?
We were a very small town, and we had two primary watering holes that a lot of the businessmen would have lunch in. One of them was the Pink Pony. The manager of the Baltimore Orioles happened to be in town playing golf, walked into the Pink Pony, and some businessmen that were having lunch motioned him over and said, "Hey, why don't you bring the Orioles out here to play spring training?" And again, that was a new phenomenon to Arizona. And he said, "Well, build me a ballpark and maybe I'll think about it." So from that day forward, in the spring of 1955, they started pre-selling seats at a stadium that didn't even exist. They made personal loans, and by June of 55, they broke ground. And by the end of October, beginning of November of 1955, the ballpark was done. Cost in the neighborhood of about $70,000, if you can imagine building a ballpark for that these days. And then they had the very first game, an exhibition game, on November 20th, 1955.
That's Scottsdale historian Joan Fudala. The stadium officially marks its 60th anniversary tomorrow at the Fall League Championship game. That's between the Scottsdale Scorpions and the Surprise Saguaros. For the show, I'm Phil Latzman.
One of the most scenic spots in the valley is the Phoenix Mountain Preserve that runs along State Route 51. The area is also known as the Dreamy Draw. You might think the name comes from its majestic views, but that is not the full story. Here's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
Dreamy Draw Park sits off Northern Avenue and State Route 51. It's a desert landscape with sprawling hills, steep mountains, and secluded valleys. Did you know Dreamy Draw was a name residents coined in the early 20th century to describe the area where miners spent long and arduous days?
It was said that the miners in this area would leave and be in a dreamy state, so they were coming back from the Dreamy Draw.
That's because of what the miners were looking for. John Southard is a Phoenix area historian. He says miners here began digging for copper in 1916, but instead discovered a significant amount of cinnabar. That's a mineral that's processed down to extract mercury, which was a commodity at a time when a world war was raging.
In fact, mercury is a neurotoxin, and working with mercury can have some very interesting effects on people. If you were to be in a mine shaft or working with material, processing it, things like that, it is entirely likely that it could have an impact on your health and your state of mind.
Southard says mining around what's now a modern-day freeway spanned from Piestewa Peak up to Shave Boulevard.
The Rico Wash, or also known as the Mercury Wash, that flows kind of perpendicular to State Route 51, was actually where some of the earliest cinnabar discoveries were made, and that's where some of the richest deposits were.
Despite its value at the time, this area produced fewer than 176-pound flasks of mercury. Mining operations shut down in the 1940s. By the late 80s, the government decided to build a highway. When the area was surveyed for construction, mining equipment was found and removed. On 23rd Street, south of Shea, is a school. It's called, well, what else? Mercury Mine Elementary School. Its softball field sits above a filled-in mercury mine. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we should know something new, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show. I'm Mark. He's Steve. In Valley traffic, I-10 westbound, the shoulder blocked at 59th Avenue. 101 northbound in the East Valley, shoulder blocked at Warner. Sunny sky, 76 degrees at KJZZ at 248.
KJZZ is supported by Universal Pictures By the Sea, a new film about the tenacity of love that stars Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie Pitt. Written and directed by Angelina Jolie Pitt, in select theaters.
Arizona's wine industry is growing. This week, the Arizona Geological Survey released an interactive map of wineries, vineyards, and tasting rooms. And this weekend, more than 30 wineries will celebrate their annual Grand Wine Festival in Chandler. To talk about this, Rod Keeling joins me. He's president of the Arizona Wine Growers Association. He and his wife also own Keeling Schaefer Vineyards in Cochise County. Rod, what is right now the state of Arizona's wine industry?
Well, to kind of give you just a little anecdotal example, you know, we were bonded by the federal government as a licensed winery in 2005, and we were the ninth in the state of Arizona. And today there's probably about 70 bonded wineries, and there's 91 state-licensed wineries.
Why the growth?
Well, there's a lot of things. Back in 2005, United States Supreme Court ruled on a non-competitive issue against the state of Michigan. It's called the Granholm decision. Granholm was the governor of Michigan at the time. And to put it bluntly, it just basically means that the state of Arizona cannot discriminate against out-of-state wineries. And so that kind of changed all the rules, and we had to go through and make sure that the law was constitutional. And we did that in 2006. We passed an update of the wine law in Arizona, and ever since then, things have really taken off.
Is there anything to the economics of being a vineyard or having a winery that are more conducive to doing it now than they were before, other than that Supreme Court case?
Well, I think wine in Arizona really got started in the early 80s, late 70s. Dr. Gordon Dutt of the University of Arizona down in Tucson was tasked with finding plants that would be low water use. And vines were one of his passions, and so he started planting vines all over the place in Arizona. And he really did kind of the basic technical scientific work to kind of prove out Arizona as a potential place to grow wines, wine fruit. And, you know, it has really been, it didn't get off to a very fast start. It took a long time for us to kind of get over the hump of all of the technical problems that were involved in growing wine in this climate. And what we found was between about 3,500 and about 5,000 feet above sea level, particularly in the south part of the state, the southern and southeastern part of the state, wine grapes are very viable, and they produce a very high quality grape which can make premium wine.
What do you think the impact of the wine industry could be on tourism? I mean, is this the kind of thing that people will come from out of state or out of the country to do a wine tour of Arizona? Is it mostly for in-state residents?
Well, I would say it's still mostly for in-state residents, although we see a lot of national and international clients come through, and our patrons come through our tasting room, and I think that's true across the state.
Do you think there will be a time when Arizona can compete with California for
wine? I think
it
already does in many ways. I mean, about 250 labels from about 12 of our wineries have been rated 85 to 90 by Wine Spectator, which is a pretty high rating.
Is that out of 100?
Yes, that's out of a 100-point scale. And then, you know, we've started seeing a lot of the wineries take their wines over to the San Francisco Chronicle competition every year, and we've been in the top 100 wines of the world in that competition several times over the last couple of years. So we're making some serious progress. I think the level of quality, it has come way, way up.
What do you think is the potential for Arizona's wine industry?
Well, the potential is actually pretty big. I mean, you think about, first off, there's a large market here in Arizona. You know, we have almost 7 million people, or maybe we're over that now. We have a metropolitan area that has a big wine buying public. One of the top wine markets for customers in the United States is you know, Phoenix, Scottsdale. So there's not a lack of a place to sell it. And I think that the other thing is we have a tremendous amount of land that is suitable for wine grapes, particularly in Cochise and southern Graham counties. The upside potential really hasn't been identified yet.
Is it a tough market to break into in the sense of convincing restaurants and bars to serve Arizona wines as opposed to more established ones?
It is. I mean, I would say when we started selling wine in earnest in 07, there was probably just a handful of restaurants in the entire state that carried Arizona wine. Now there's probably 100. And it's become much more acceptable, particularly for those restaurants that are looking for a local product. You know, the local movement has helped us a lot in that situation. We also see that, you know, a lot of the major retailers, wine retailers, have special sections for Arizona, like Whole Foods and AJ's. We've made a huge progress in the entering into that marketplace, but we still got a long ways to go.
Rod Keeling is the president of the Arizona Wine Growers Association. He and his wife also own Keeling Schaefer Vineyards in Cochise County.
We visited a local vintner to get a taste of how the state affects his business.
So we're opening our 2012 Syrah.
Kurt Dunham owns Lawrence Dunham Vineyards, a winemaking company that just started bottling in 2009, just a few hundred cases. This year, Dunham says they made 3,000 cases. He credits the quick growth to the location of his vineyard, the Chiricahua Mountains in the southeastern corner of Arizona.
There's a little bit of nuance to every spot you grow in. So the earlier you can figure out what your place can do, what it does do, how it impacts the grapes, and how the grapes then impact the wine, I think the more successful you'll be as not only a grower, but also as a winemaker.
Dunham says the grapes grow at 5,000 feet, getting plenty of sunshine and temperatures that swing from high to low.
And I think that does something magical to the grape skins, because we got tremendous extraction and flavor just off of one-year-old plants.
And while we may not enjoy swinging temperatures, Dunham says it's key for the grapes. The plant thickens the grape skin to protect it from the changing environment, and that's what gives the wine its flavor. But what's also important, he says, is that the varietal of wine grape pairs well with the location.
Most wine regions I've studied, from Willamette Valley to Napa Valley to Sonoma County, spend about a generation putting in grapes that they want to put in instead of what the earth tells them to put in. And I think Arizona's gone through some of that too. Arizona's
wine industry has really grown the last few years. I think because we're starting to figure out what we need to be putting in the ground instead of what the owner or the winemaker wants to put in the ground.
Now we just need to figure out which cheese pairs with that wine.
The Rebel Set is a local band that features driving drums, chunky guitar, and the unmistakable sound of the Farfisa organ. I spoke with Joe Zimmerman, songwriter and lead vocalist for The Rebel Set, about how he defines the band's sound, which falls somewhere between two classic genres.
Garage rock or something. We used to be a little more surfy, but we've kind of evolved a little more.
How are garage and surf different?
Well, surf is traditionally instrumental and very like clean with a lot of reverb and stuff, and then garage is a little more rough, noisy, and I guess we're somewhere in between those.
So is there something appealing to you about the time period in which those forms of music originally became popular that's appealing to you?
I think just how primitive it is. It was done quickly and, you know, by modern standards, the recording techniques were pretty primitive.
Like how so?
Yeah. Just the, you know, there wasn't like 24 tracks of drums, or, you know, it was like two tracks for the whole band, for the whole recording. Or, I don't know, just the way that that sounds when you do things that way and let things like instruments bleed onto each other's tracks and stuff rather than everything nice and clean and...
Is there more room for, like, happy accidents when you do it that way?
Yeah, on the last recordings we did, which haven't been released yet, there's a point where there is no organ part, but that microphone picking up everything else made some interesting sounds that we turned up for that part that are just weird, you know, ambient room sounds that never would have happened if it, you know, literally was accidental.
So you get some surprises when you listen back to what you recorded.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
How do you explain a band that plays surf music in the middle of the desert?
Well, there's been actually a lot of surf going back to the 50s. It's not surf, but Duane Eddy, sort of a forerunner of surf and twanginess. And then Al Casey, who played with Duane Eddy, who went on to play with the Beach Boys and became a studio musician, playing on a lot of surf recordings, made his own Surf and Hootenanny album. I don't know why it's in the desert, but there seems to have always been a fair amount.
So your music is, as we've talked about, evocative of past eras, and I'm curious how you sort of balance keeping a fidelity to what has been, but also putting your stamp on it in 2015.
It may sound oxymoronic or something, but we never wanted to be like retro. We just wanted to play those styles, but play them now and not limit ourselves in terms of they didn't do it that way, so we can't do it that way.
How do you decide sort of how much to take from the past and then implement it into what you're doing now?
There's not really any a lot of thought that goes into that. We just sort of, when you play using equipment that's like 50 years old, it just kind of sounds that way.
But that's a conscious decision, right? To play on older instruments.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain things that you can't, like the Farfisa that Katie uses.
The organ.
Yeah, it has a very distinct sound that is hard to replicate. So if you want that sound, that's the only way to go.
That's Joe Zimmerman of The Rebel Set. The band will be playing this Monday at Valley Bar in Phoenix. If you know of other local bands we should be listening to, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
And if you'll be leaving the house this weekend, there's plenty of stuff to do. Tonight at 7:30, Mark, the Nick Mason Quartet playing at the Nash in Phoenix. Nick Mason, drummer for the legendary band Pink Floyd. I cannot imagine what he looks like and plays like now.
Well, if you go to the Nash, you can find out. Also, the Territorial Cup will be decided tomorrow at Sun Devil Stadium. ASU and U of A hit the gridiron.
And the tribute band Fran Halen plays tonight and tomorrow at Casino Arizona at Salt River.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. News director, Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
Thanks very much for listening. If you have any ideas, send them to us, theshow@kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. All Things Considered, up next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Hope you enjoy the sunny, warm weekend. It's 3 o'clock.